Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, do those who called the outing of covert CIA official Valerie Plame Wilson a scandal owe the White House an apology for suggesting it outed her as revenge against her husband, Joe Wilson? Some commentators seem to think so. We'll be joined by journalist Robert Perry for the latest on the coverage of the Plame Wilson affair. Also on the show, the hiring of a Bush speechwriter who helped sell the Iraq War as the new voice on the Washington Post's op-ed page is only the latest example of the disturbing confluence of journalism and PR. There's a new book out on the use of PR in the Iraq War. We'll hear from John Stauber, co-author of The Best War Ever, Lies, Damned Lies, and the Mess in Iraq. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press.
Everyone is entitled to his or her opinion, says Katie Couric, introducing the free speech guest commentary segment on the new CBS Evening News. But that's not quite how Rush Limbaugh saw it as he appeared on the segment on September 7th. Limbaugh used his free speech appearance to call those whose opinions don't support White House policies unpatriotic. Quote, "Patriotism is rallying behind the country, regardless of party affiliation, to defeat Islamofascism. Patriotism is supporting our troops in the battlefield, not undermining the mission and morale." Close quote. Limbaugh's commentary, in effect denouncing large numbers of Americans who oppose the Iraq War as unpatriotic, may not be a good way for the new CBS Evening News program to make friends, but it may not be the only problem. Quoted in USA Today on September 13th, news analyst Andrew Tyndall explained that in the first week of the new CBS broadcast, ABC's and NBC's nightly news shows contained about half hard news and half features, interviews, and commentary. The CBS Evening News, by contrast, was just one quarter hard news and three quarters features, interviews, and commentary. Could this have anything to do with the program's post-hype third-place finish?
For a useful contrast in the ways alternative and establishment press cover the same story, look at Max Blumenthal's September 12th report in The Nation, ABC 9/11 docudrama's Right Wing Roots, and compare it to the New York Times report of the same day. From the Times story, we learn that critics of ABC's miniseries, The Path to 9/11, are concerned about, quote, some affiliations, close quote, of the director, David L. Cunningham. The lone example provided by the Times describes Cunningham's, quote, links to a non-denominational Christian group based in Hawaii called Youth with a Mission, or YWAM, which was founded by his father, Lauren Cunningham, which promotes youth involvement in religious outreach around the world, close quote. What's so disturbing about that? The Times doesn't explain. In The Nation, by contrast, we learn that Lauren Cunningham is a proponent of Christian Reconstructionism, a far-right, anti-constitutional, theocratic movement, and that the younger Cunningham, the director, is a founder of a spin-off to YWAM called the Film Institute, whose mission statement declares that it is, quote, dedicated to a godly transformation and revolution to and through the film and television industry, close quote. A YWAM newsletter once declared the Film Institute's, quote, first project is a doozy. Simply being referred to as the Untitled History Project, it is already being called the television event of the decade, close quote. The Untitled History Project was the working title of The Path to 9/11. Certainly that's relevant information for a discussion of the political background of ABC's miniseries. The Nation was able to find it out and publish it. The New York Times either didn't know or didn't think you needed to.
Counterspin talked last week about the New York Times rewriting recent history in an article in which they stated that the White House's justification for invading Iraq was the possibility that Saddam Hussein might develop weapons of mass destruction. Of course, in reality, the White House claimed Hussein already had such weapons, and after FAIR activists complained, the Times eventually corrected the record. But media continue to perpetuate falsehoods about the most basic facts of the Iraq War. On September 10th, for example, Vice President Dick Cheney, appearing on NBC's Meet the Press, declared that Saddam Hussein, quote, was deemed by the intelligence community to have resumed his WMD programs when he kicked out the inspectors, close quote. Later, he repeated that, quote, inspectors have been kicked out of Iraq, close quote. But the reality is that weapons inspectors were not kicked out of Iraq. They left on their own accord when they were informed by the Clinton administration that the U.S. was about to start bombing the country. But didn't host Tim Russert correct Cheney's falsehood? We often find journalists reluctant to challenge the claims of powerful officials, even when they're demonstrably false. But in Russert's case, the explanation may be simply that this particular falsehood is one he believes himself. In December 1999, Russert declared on air, quote, "One year ago, Saddam Hussein threw out all the inspectors who could find his chemical or nuclear capability," close quote. And 2 weeks later, he repeated, quote, "One year ago, the inspectors were told, get out, by Saddam Hussein," close quote. Repeating inaccurate history doesn't make it true, of course. It does make it confusing for viewers trying to make sense of the situation.
3 years ago, then-FCC Chair Michael Powell launched a proceeding on the effects of local ownership on television news as part of his drive to further deregulate media and allow for even greater consolidation. But when a report on the subject, commissioned under Powell, turned out not to support his argument that consolidation has no ill effects on local news, the report, it seems, disappeared. It only surfaced this week when someone leaked it to California Senator Barbara Boxer, who questioned current FCC Chairman Kevin Martin about it at his renomination hearing. According to the report, locally owned stations, in fact, deliver nearly 6 minutes more of total news and almost 5.5 more minutes of local news than stations with non-local owners. For a 30-minute broadcast, those numbers are pretty remarkable and pretty damning for big media's allies at the FCC. Allies like Martin, who succeeded Powell and who supported a move that would have dramatically raised ownership caps had it not been struck down by an appeals court. Martin told Barbara Boxer he hadn't been aware of the localism report and has promised to keep an open mind on media consolidation as the FCC embarks once again on a review of its ownership rules. Open records, of course, would be nice too.
And finally, in a September 7th commentary, CBSNews.com editorial director Dick Meyer slammed George Bush's statement on CBS Evening News that, quote, "I've said to people we don't torture and we don't," close quote. Meyer summed up Bush's comments as beyond doublespeak and above spin and said Bush was not telling the truth. Quote, "We've been lied to and we are still being lied to by the president," close quote. Meyer's words incensed Fox News star Bill O'Reilly, who in a September 12th FoxNews.com column accused Meyer of putting us all in danger. O'Reilly claimed, quote, "Meyer fails to provide evidence of this charge. What's he talking about? Is keeping people awake for long periods of time torture? Has the USA gouged anybody's eyes out?" Close quote. In easily discoverable fact, the U.S. State Department does list sleep deprivation among the many practices it condemns as torture when practiced by other countries. And worse than gouging anybody's eyes out, the U.S. has killed prisoners in custody. According to documents wrested from the Defense Department by the ACLU, at least 21 prisoners held in U.S. prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan were victims of homicide, and at least 8 of those while undergoing abusive interrogation techniques, otherwise known as torture. The infamous photographs from Abu Ghraib also document acts that would qualify as torture by any reasonable standard. But O'Reilly has long maintained that Abu Ghraib wasn't newsworthy, so that might explain his trouble this time around. O'Reilly concluded his tirade by suggesting that perhaps Meyer himself deserved a little physical abuse. Quote, "I am tired of guys like Meyer accusing this nation of torture. Put up some evidence if you have it, sir. If you do not, go down to a New York City fire station and see what happens to you," close quote. But torture is wrong, right, Bill?
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Early in September, news that former State Department official Richard Armitage was the original leaker of covert CIA official Valerie Plame Wilson's identity caused a rethinking by many journalists of the entire Plame affair. Many mainstream commentators were saying the outing of Plame Wilson was just an innocent bit of gossip, never a scandal at all, and calling for those who said it was to apologize to Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and others, smeared by the suggestion that Plame Wilson's outing was revenge by White House officials on her husband, Joe Wilson, for his role in undermining their claims about Iraq's nuclear program. Journalist Robert Perry has been following the Plame Wilson story carefully on his website, consortiumnews.com. His latest article on the affair, U.S. Press Bigwigs Screw Up Again, takes a different view of the story. He joins us now by phone from Virginia. Robert Perry, welcome back to Counterspin.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, to believe the scenario that emerged in early September, one had to accept first the concept of Dick Armitage's innocence, that his dropping of Plame Wilson's name in a conversation with columnist Bob Novak was an innocent bit of gossip and was not part of a White House campaign. But one also had to believe that the news story somehow proved there was no White House campaign against the Wilsons. As the Washington Post put it in a September 1st editorial, quote, "It follows that one of the most sensational charges leveled against the Bush White House, that it orchestrated the leak of Ms. Plame's identity to ruin her career and thus punish Mr. Wilson, is untrue," close quote. Robert Perry, granting for the moment that Armitage's role was innocent, would that necessarily mean that there was no White House campaign of revenge against the Wilsons?
No, there definitely was a campaign by the White House to harm the Wilsons. There was an effort that dated back almost a month or so before Robert Novak did his original column in July of 2003 that intended to damage Joe Wilson and to disclose his wife's involvement with the CIA, which ultimately destroyed her career. So there was certainly a White House effort. There were about half a dozen reporters who were approached in various ways with this information, and there were other reporters who were being encouraged to ask about Mrs. Wilson's role. So you had this effort that is there is no question existed, where the White House was trying to get reporters onto this element of the story. And it just so happened that one of the first ones who was able to get the information to break it was Robert Novak, but he was certainly not the only reporter being pushed in that direction.
So what did you make of the Washington Post's editorial claiming that allegations of such a campaign are just untrue?
Well, I think it was a very bad editorial and was very misleading and very unfair to Joe Wilson. It basically accused Joe Wilson of being the one responsible for his wife's outing, because the Post said when he criticized the president, he should have known that that would have led inevitably to his wife's being outed. It certainly doesn't. You know, in Washington, it's a very rare thing for anyone in government or in the news media to bandy about the name of a covert CIA officer. People assume when you are talking about individuals in the CIA that they are covert. There are some that aren't, but you generally assume they are, and you treat that information very cautiously because you do not want to cause the destruction of someone's career, but more importantly, put someone in danger and put in danger the people they've worked with abroad. So this is not something that is so casually done, and to believe that people like Dick Armitage, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Louis Libby were just unaware of the danger that can come from talking about the identity of a CIA officer is just not credible. And it's not credible when Fred Hyde, of the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, adopts that position either.
Well, you're getting to the issue of Armitage's innocent role in the whole thing. Doesn't the scenario have it that Armitage was a lieutenant of Secretary of State Colin Powell, who was at odds with the White House over Iraq, so neither of them would have gone along with the White House's smear campaign?
It doesn't follow at all. Armitage was actually much closer to the White House and very close to Karl Rove. It had been Armitage's job before the administration began to negotiate with Karl Rove on bringing Colin Powell into the administration, which was a very big deal for Bush's administration. They wanted the gravitas that Powell could bring, and the guy that set that up was Armitage. And the man he worked with in setting it up was Rove. So they were actually fairly close. So the idea of them working together is certainly not hard to believe. And people also have forgotten another key point. In 1998, Richard Armitage was one of the 18 signatories to this famous letter that the Project for the New American Century had written to President Clinton, urging him to invade Iraq. So Armitage was not some dove. He may not have been as active or as involved leading up to the war as some other people were, but he was certainly not just some fellow out there who was opposed to going to war with Iraq. He wasn't.
Well, there's an article also back in February on Slate.com by former Time journalist John Dickerson casting new light on Colin Powell's role, suggesting that Colin Powell may have been on board with the whole smear campaign of the White House, too. Robert, as we speak, it's September 14th, and today Robert Novak's latest column has come out disputing Armitage's account of the leak. How does this change the facts as we know them?
Well, Robert Novak said in his column pretty much what he had said actually right after his original column back in July of 2003. Novak said then in an interview with Newsday that he wasn't trying to find this out, that people in the administration had come to him with the information about Plame's identity, that they felt it was important to get out, and that he then wrote it. And he pretty much recounts a similar position in describing his interview with Armitage. Novak says he did ask about the circumstances surrounding Wilson's trip to Niger back in 2002, and that Armitage then goes off into describing the role of Valerie Plame, which was actually a very minor role in that trip, but it was something the White House was pushing at the time. So what Novak describes is that it wasn't just some gossip being dropped by Armitage about the CIA officer. It was a case of Armitage leaking this information and essentially encouraging Novak to use it, which puts this whole thing in a whole different light and also suggests that the journalists from David Broder through the Washington Post editorial page through the New York Times front page stories were highly credulous of the administration's new position when they went along and accepted the idea of Armitage's innocence. It's not supported by what Novak said in his new column.
Well, commentators including Bill O'Reilly of Fox News and David Broder, the Washington Post columnist, have called for apologies based on this new media scenario that the White House did not have a smear campaign going against the Wilsons. But don't we still know, just to sum up the facts, Robert Perry, don't we still know that Cheney, Libby, and Rove were trying to discredit Wilson?
Correct. They were trying to discredit Wilson, and they were trying to leak the identity of his wife. But even before the conversation between Novak and Armitage, Libby was meeting with Judy Miller of the New York Times, trying to get her to run this information in the New York Times. Rove ended up being a source for both Novak on Plame's identity and for Time magazine, trying to get them to go with this story about who Plame was and her role with her husband's trip. So this was clearly a case where a number of people in the administration were trying to leak this information to undercut Joe Wilson and his criticism of the president's claims about Iraq's nuclear program. It doesn't really matter all that much which person moved first with which journalist. It was a concerted effort by a number of key people in the administration to get this piece of information out, and it's information that was extremely harmful to U.S. national security interests by putting out the name of a CIA officer and exposing her efforts to be involved in counterproliferation operations.
We've been speaking with journalist Robert Perry. You can read his latest article on the Plame affair, U.S. Press Bigwigs Screw Up Again, at consortiumnews.com. Robert Perry, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
In the very early days of the Bush administration's self-declared war on terror, a military official told the Washington Post, "This is the most information-intensive war you can imagine. We're going to lie about things." But even having been explicitly warned, the U.S. media in large part went on to report credulously the claims of the White House regarding the reasons for and likely outcomes of the attacks on Afghanistan and then Iraq. Without the challenge of a critical press corps, the U.S. public have been subjected to a PR campaign of epic proportion, exemplified by the toppling of a statue of Saddam Hussein by jubilant Iraqis that turned out to be a Potemkin-style psyops maneuver by the U.S. military. But even as many people, including journalists, have come to question virtually every aspect of the White House's bloody misadventures in Iraq, the same folks who orchestrated the war are setting up to repeat their performance in other countries. And, in important ways, media media aren't offering much more challenge than they did 5 years ago. If being told that they would be lied to and then being lied to didn't serve to wake up the press corps, what will? We're joined now by telephone from Wisconsin by John Stauber. He's the founder and director of the Center for Media and Democracy, a veteran surveyor of public relations, and author with Sheldon Rampton of the new book, The Best War Ever, Lies, Damned Lies, and the Mess in Iraq. Welcome back to Counterspin, John Stauber.
Thank you, Janine, for having me on.
Well, I suppose any day's news could serve as a lead-in for your new book, but here's something. The Washington Post op-ed page has made a new hire, and it's Michael Gerson, a top speechwriter for George W. Bush. He helped write Colin Powell's crucially misleading speech to the UN, and he came up with that paranoid soundbite warning about Iraq's nuclear program, the first sign of a smoking gun might be a mushroom cloud. So here's someone whose job has been to use language deceptively to spin people in favor of this war, and the Washington Post is going to give him a platform as a source of information on, among other things, the war. I wonder what your response is to that.
It's stunning. It's stunning, but unfortunately to me and to you and the folks at FAIR, it's not surprising because this is the way the Washington Post and the other major media work. In our first book on the war, I'm not sure if we mentioned Gerson, but he makes it into The Best War Ever, our current book, because he was one of the people that the CIA explicitly warned, one of the White House people, before President Bush told his lie about Saddam seeking uranium from Africa, that that information that Bush put into the 2003 State of the Union was false.
Well, propaganda and PR are your areas of expertise. Listeners may know your previous book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You. Any administration would do PR to persuade the public of the rightness of military action. Is it that the Iraq War has taken it to a new level? Is that it?
Every administration seems to take propaganda to a new level. And, of course, the whole business of propaganda began way back in World War I with Woodrow Wilson. The industry, public relations industry, was launched out of that war. I think what's so frightening about the current situation is that what worked in selling the Iraq War is something called the big lie tactic. And this is something most associated with the Nazi regime of Adolf Hitler. It's very simple. The people in power state the most audacious sorts of information that they know to be false, but that they know will incite the public. Saddam was behind 9/11. Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Saddam is in league with Al-Qaeda. Those are the statements and the insinuations that were used to sell this war. Those statements were not able to be proven. In fact, the overwhelming evidence on every one of them was that they were false and misleading before Bush launched the attack March 20th, 2003. And yet, because the mainstream media echoed and repeated those statements in the United States, and because the mainstream media refused to challenge those lies and deceptions, the big lie tactic was allowed to work. There's not much more you can say that's a worse indictment of a nation's news media than it allowed the big lie tactic to work to get us into this mess we're in Iraq.
Well, we know, and our listeners know, that we do sometimes see the information that runs counter to the White House line on Iraq and other issues. It's not that the countervailing information is nowhere to be found. How is it that the occasional media challenges that we see don't somehow seem to snowball into a big no to the White House's plans?
It's because the news media, and especially television, decides what it's going to emphasize. And although it's true, journalists and investigators, any citizen who's a sharp thinker and has access to all the media available now online can get to the truth, most Americans still get their news from television, and most of what they see on television now and in the lead-up to the war echoed over and over the administration's position. For instance, in March of 2003, one of the few mainstream media journalists and personalities who was airing critics of the administration's march to war was Phil Donahue. MSNBC fired Phil Donahue, ended his program shortly before the attack on Iraq, and they said, well, his ratings are bad. But then a memo leaked out from NBC. His ratings were fine, but NBC had fired him for the offense of airing critics of the administration and critics of the war at a time when their competitors, the other networks such as Fox and CNN, were wrapping themselves in the flag and promoting the war. So the fact is that the critical voices that were pointing out to Americans that indeed these are falsehoods, lies, and deceptions that are being used to sell us into war were out there in places, but they were overwhelmed and shouted down, if you will, by most of the mainstream media.
Well, making that point that critics have been and continue to be, unfortunately, we've seen some encroachment around the edges, but still largely locked out of mainstream media's conversation about the Iraq War and foreign policy. How are you going about publicizing a book that makes these very critical points about the mainstream media itself?
It's a very interesting question. When our book, Weapons of Mass Deception, came out in July of 2003, it was the first to reveal this sell job, and it became a bestseller, and even a New York Times bestseller, and it was our best-selling book ever. But it received the same treatment as other critics of the administration's statements on the war. It was mostly ignored by mainstream media. This time around, with the best war ever, we've sort of become the media. We've put together, Sheldon Rampton and I are executive producers of our first film, a little 4-minute synopsis of the book that's airing on websites all over the place, and anyone can see it by going to thebestwarever.com. Tens of thousands of people, as we talk, have already viewed the video. In fact, a lot more people are going to view this video than will ever read the book. And this is one way that we're trying to get around this fact that the mainstream media has censored and ignored critics of the administration on Iraq.
We've been speaking with John Stauber of the Center for Media and Democracy. His brand new book with Sheldon Rampton is The Best War Ever, Lies, Damned Lies, and the Mess in Iraq. Thanks very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.